Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tevold, and joining me in the studio today are...
Peter R.H.
And Stephen Fenn.
And we got a whole bunch of talk to you about today. We have a report from a reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, about the need for support for youth who've aged out of care to be able to succeed in post-secondary. What are you going to be talking about today, Peter?
This has been going on for almost 30 years about the vaccines in general, including the important ones, the polio. Measles cause autism. Now, I came across something that convinced me of your... No, but the thing is that autism is... It is genetic. Mm-hmm. So if it's genetic, how can something after the birth... alter it? And so I kind of I found that out by accident, and I have a bit of a background on what happened over the last about 30 years on this.
Isn't it mostly because parents are getting are having kids later, and when you have later, there are more of these genetic and epigenetic?
Oh, no, maybe. But let's save that for the conversation
okay.
at the end of
I know,
the show.
I know. Anyway.
That's a good point. Stephen, it's been a while since we've seen you here.
Yeah.
What are you here to tell us about today?
So I just came back from a trip to Europe and Turkey, and it's really interesting because, you know, like when you're in North America, you do follow the news about what's happening in these places, especially in Europe, for example, with respect to Ukraine, with respect to the rise of the far right and so forth. But when you're actually like physically in Europe, and you actually talk to people, there's a little bit more of a nuance, more of a texture to it. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about that because I think it gives a little bit of light as to what's going on and where politics in these places are trending, and also where the economy to some extent.
Great. Well, we're going to start off with a report from Danny Nesvadarani, our reporter here at CJSF. So we'll go with that, and then we'll be back with Stephen in just about 5 minutes.
This is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. United Way BC has recently brought attention to an underrepresented demographic in the province currently facing increasing rates of food insecurity. Post-secondary students who have previously been in government care. To help address this issue, United Way BC has released the Youth Futures Education Fund, which, as stated by United Way, provides low barrier access to funds for basic living expenses like food, rent, tech, childcare, and more. CJSF reached out to United Way BC for an interview in order to learn more about the fund, as well as the issue it aims to address. We got in contact with Trisha Dulku, United Way's Strategic Initiatives Manager, who spoke with us about the findings from a recent TD survey that present growing levels of food insecurity among post-secondary students, and thus the need for the Youth Futures Education Fund.
Yeah, so that TD survey, the new one, it does show that majority of Canadian post-secondary students, 92%, are stressed about money. And there have been a lot of studies done focused on specific institutions as well, even within BC, talking about how food insecure students are. Now, this particular priority population that we're focused on with the Youth Futures Education Fund are youth who've been in government care. So for those of your listeners who don't understand what that term is of government care, essentially it means that these are youth who've been in the foster care system for a period of their life growing up. So they didn't necessarily have the stability of family, that stable home. Oftentimes they might have been kind of going from home to home without having that sense of security that many of us would have, particularly those of us who are familiar with, you know, a nuclear family lifestyle. And so what happens is that when they turn 19, they age out. And when they age out, they lose access to any of their foster care parents or caregivers that they were connected to. They lose access to any of those support workers that are available to them through the Ministry of Children and Family Development. And they're essentially just handed their birth certificates and told good luck. So they're out on their own. And so when they're, and these are kids, these are young people who really want to pursue their futures. You know, they have dreams, they have hopes, like all other young people. They want to get a good job, they want to start their own families. But it's so hard when you don't have that stability of support that you can lean on. And even though there is the BC government's tuition waiver program, which does waive the cost of tuition as well as mandatory fees for a lot of these young people, it's still, and I'm sure you know this, when you're going to school, it's not just about the tuition. There's the cost of rent, making sure you have a roof over your head. There's the cost for food and groceries. And now more than ever, those costs are climbing as well. Sometimes there's the need for really expensive textbooks or particular school supplies. Or even, you know, given some of the hard situations that some of these young people have dealt with being in the care system, maybe there's like a triggering situation that can come up where they suddenly need to access mental health and counseling supports. And so what the Youth Futures Education Fund does is it provides these young people with that supplemental funding support for all of these needs so that they can really just pursue their studies and have that stability.
Dolku then discussed the need for further community and government investment for students facing food insecurity.
I think whenever different organizations, institutions, parts of our community come together to support our young people, then that's a good thing, because then it can really help make sure that it provides that stable, that spine, that support that these folks need so they can really learn to stand on their own two feet. And when these are young people that we should be investing in, because at the end of the day, they're our future, right? They're the ones who are going to be working, building up, and part of the workforce. They're the ones who are going to be paying into CPP and all of those kinds of programs that, you know, folks who are getting older will be needing support, and they're the ones who are going to be that front line. And so anytime we can invest in these young people, and I don't just mean United Way, all parties across the board, government institutions, even in the private sector, corporate entities, when we're investing in our young people, it's a good investment because it's going to pay dividends for us all down the line.
Next, some of the stories that United Way BC has been hearing from post-secondary institutions regarding food insecurity on campus.
There are a lot of stories that we've heard over the years, especially since this fund was, the YFEF fund was first put together in 2015. I can tell you that most recently, we've been hearing more and more from our partners at all of the public post-secondary institutions about the food insecurity that their staff are witnessing right on campus. I mean, I'll give you an example. So just a few months ago, we heard a report about a student attending a university that's based on Vancouver Island who has been in government care and is pursuing their studies there, but they were found to be dumpster diving for essentials that they needed on campus. And so these are the kinds of situations that we really want to mitigate with the Youth Futures Education Fund, because it's important for young people to have the agency that they need, as well as the dignity of choice when it comes to those essentials that they absolutely need. And we don't want youth to feel like they're having to be in survival mode when they're just trying to study and get ahead in life. We really want them to thrive so that they can access all those supports that they need.
Lastly, Trisha Dolku reaffirmed the importance of the Youth Futures Education Fund as a way of aiding students who have previously been in government care.
I mean, I'll give you another case in point. We had a young person that's attending an institution in northern BC, and they were evicted from the home that they were sharing with a couple other youth who've also been in care. And so the three of them were looking for stable housing, which was very hard to find close to campus that was affordable. One of the things that YFEF did was ensure that they had access to funds very quickly in a very low barrier manner, so that they can quickly secure a living space, including the cost for a damage deposit. And that's one of the things as well, is that when you're living paycheck to paycheck, or you're really relying on high interest debts like credit cards to try and take care of you in emergencies or unexpected situations, that in itself can be very emotionally draining. And so with YFEF, it's really vital for that that fund to be available, especially for these unexpected and emergent situations too.
Once again, that was our conversation with Trisha Dolku, the Strategic Initiatives Manager for United Way BC, on the Youth Futures Education Fund, which aims to serve post-secondary students, and in particular post-secondary students who have previously been in government care, who are facing issues such as food insecurity. This has been Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that report. It is kind of crazy that the system for youth who've been in care really kind of hangs them out, expects them to be, after a very troubled childhood in many cases, expects them to be able to just thrive without any real supports once they hit 18. I mean, I think of my own youth and many others, you know, I mean, I had a good family and all that stuff and all the supports. But, you know, if when I hit 18, if that was it, no more advice from parents, no more backstopping if you need a little money, no idea that if it needed to, even if I never needed it, I could move back over a little bit. It's a little wild that there isn't more supports for young people who've been in care after they age out. 18 is still pretty young.
Well, I agree. And I think as someone from a different cultural background, right, I'm from more of an East Asian cultural background where there's more expectation of continuity both in supports but also to some extent in obligations. I do find sort of the North American nuclear family, you're out on, and you know, you're out on the street at age 18, you're on your own now, kind of motto.
Well, it's not quite like that for most families, but yeah, I know what you mean. There's still more expectation
you always hear stories about people, oh yeah, you know, you're 18 now, start paying rent.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a couple.
And certainly a lot of, you know, a little criticism, or at least looking side-eyed at folks who maybe are in their 20s and still living a home.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I lived, you know, to some extent with my parents long after that cutoff. And I am not ashamed of that. But also I have a couple of minor sociological observations to make on this point. First of all, you know, there is across the political spectrum some degree of concern about the decline in total fertility rates and the fact that people are having children much later, in fact, which kind of ties into the whole autism debate later. But one thing is that I think partially the North American, you could also call it kind of the Northern European Protestant model of family formation, has to some extent stopped working in the postmodernist world. And what I mean by that is, if you need 4 years of university education and then another 5 years or 10 years of professional world acculturation before you can go off and launch on your own as a middle-class individual, middle-class professional, it is actually very, very challenging for people to find their footing when they're young. And I think that's a great pity, because when you're young, when you're in your 20s, it should be the moment when you should be able to have the most fun in life. And what's kind of transformed into, at least in the last little while, is this miserable grind set for everyone to try and hustle together enough down payment to buy a home. And it's so grim in many ways. And I think I'm not saying like return to the multi-generational household. I'm saying, to some extent, we need to reconsider to what extent is sort of this very nuclearized model of atomized model of individual and society and the household and society even tenable. Like, it was, you know, I'm sure that 50, 60, 70 years ago, this looked like the absolute cutting edge of progress. You move out, you buy your own home, you know, you get a job. And now it just looks like we're trying to pursue kind of a past ideal that might not be the best fit for today's world. And that's partially part of my deeper comment as well, right? Like, we can make homes more affordable, but we can't change the fact that career cycles are just so much longer nowadays.
And rounding back to our sort of point where we started with the idea that what the supports young adults need to thrive, and that, you know, in the case of often with youth in care, when they get to 18, they're sort of out of the system and on their own, really on their own, you know, which isn't the case for most people with families. You know, for many people now, the idea that the goal of buying a house is almost unattainable without, in many cases, you know, support from family. You know, so it's, you know,
and it's
and
not
that sort of I can't think of the word, but, you know, how do we expect, you know, kids who've grown up in care to be able to share those kind of the aspirations, which has been sort of a standard within our society for a long time, you know, without some degree of additional support. So I don't just mean money. I think it can be a lot of things. It's a bigger conversation than we can have right now, but.
And I would add, you know, it's actually kind of nicely ties into my next topic, which is Europe. Is that I just came back from Europe, and one of my close friends, he's doing really well professionally. He's a consultant and at Deloitte & Touche, and he's just been seconded to the Apple AI team. So he's making a lot of money. He just had a kid, and he bought a house, you know, like a loft. And I was like, oh, how much does this whole thing cost? And, you know, like, I kind of know how much his mortgage would cost. But what surprised me was that his childcare in Greater London, not even Central London, is costing £1,800. That's more than $3,000 Canadian per month. And that's just how much it costs for a full-time kindergarten in Greater London. So you add, you know, like housing and childcare together, it's really unaffordable for younger people in today's economy. But actually, it kind of nicely transitions to what I was going to talk about, which is that, you know, like, I was in Europe for a week and a half, kind of 2 weeks kind of a thing. I came back last week, and partially I was meeting up with friends one of whom was getting married, and he was having a stag party in Prague. But also I was just traveling off on my own, and that was including going to places like Istanbul, where I had a great time. But what was really interesting to me was sort of the general social trends. The first thing that was interesting to me was that Istanbul, to some extent, kind of looks like what a post-Trump America might look like. The way I say that is not like Islamic or anything like that. It's more like the president of Turkey, Erdogan, he's actually been in place in various forms as prime minister or as president. He's actually changed the constitution since 1998. And he's been around one way or another with some degree, with, I would say, actually, most degree of democratic legitimacy. He does seem to be the most popular figure in the country democratically. But he's very, very, very unpopular with urban liberals and intellectuals and so on. So I was doing one of these tours of the Hagia Sophia, the Hagia Sophia, they call it Hagia Sophia locally. And my tour guide, who's, you know, speaks perfect English, is a middle class professional. He was joking about how he was looking forward to the next election, which is in 2028. You know, hope springs eternal. And he was kind of making all these kind of little snide anti-Erdogan comments. Mm-hmm. And the way that went down actually reminded me a little bit of people in coastal metros in America talking about Trump. It's almost like this unstoppable force, and they're kind of in the minority now. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, Turkey is kind of a funny comparison because Turkey has got like 40% inflation, but on the street, like, you know, the economy feels fine, right? Like, right. Like on the street, you know, the economy feels normal. It doesn't feel like a panic. It's just that if you look at official figures, inflation is 40%.
Right.
I think if you look at recent economic trends in Trump's America, where there's all these kind of slightly corrupt or allegedly corrupt transactions, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, the TikTok sale and so forth. But in the meantime, the restaurants are booming. It reminds me a little bit of that. And when I went back to Eastern Europe, it was kind of the opposite. It was kind of interesting because when you read news items about Europe nowadays, it's like, oh, you know, Western Europe isn't doing well. Eastern Europe is booming. And you actually then spend some time in Eastern Europe. One thing that's interesting to me is that all the young people have left. They've left for London. They've left for Paris. There's a lot of tourism, which is, you know, increasing the local economy. But the local young people do not seem to be in great numbers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is, but that was something interesting. But yeah, you know, like it's the other thing I would say is that it's surprising to some degree how much the effect the war in Ukraine has had on the European economy.
In what way?
I think you read the economic figures and you talk about, you know, you see all these figures about how there are massive layoffs in German heavy industry, and you assume that's fairly localized or in certain industries. But actually, I think what's really happened, and that's everywhere in Europe, but especially in the developed parts of Western Europe, is that wages are flat, but the cost of everything has gone up like 50%, 100%. So food is more expensive, fuel is more expensive, heating is more expensive. And obviously, that causes services like childcare and stuff like that mm-hmm. to be more expensive as well. In the meantime, wages are exactly the same as they were 5 years ago. So this is quite different from North America, where wages are up.
Not so different.
I mean, it's not so different from Canada, but wages are up a lot in the States. Mm-hmm. Wages are up less in Canada. But in Europe, wages are literally just flat. So graduate salary in the UK 5 years ago, 10 years ago, was like £32,000. It is exactly the same today. It hasn't moved a single pound. So that was really interesting to me, and I think this is also part of why the political misery is intensifying. I have a friend whose family owns a small factory in provincial England, the southwest coast of England, and it's about it's a factory of maybe like 50 people, less than 100 people, and he was telling me that five of the workmen in his factory went on a Reform Party march a couple of weekends ago. And he was like, this is very significant. Like, he's not a Reform supporter, of course. Yep. But he was like, you know, this is a small factory. A very significant fraction of the employees at our factory are now fairly fairly virulent, fairly devoted devotees of the Reform Party and its ideology.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Reform Party? People may not be that.
It's very confusing because it's one of these things where the party has gone through a billion different renamings, but it's actually really the same thing. Yep. So the Reform Party, the best way to understand it is that it's headed by Nigel Farage. And Nigel Farage really came to the spotlight in 2015, 2016, partly because he has always been the face of Euroscepticism in the UK, which is to say quitting the European Union.
Yeah.
And at that time, I believe he was heading what was called the UK Independence Party. Yeah. And then successfully that pushed for the referendum on the
Yeah, and he was a big figure in the Brexit.
And he was a big figure in the Brexit debate. And then he became a big Donald Trump supporter. And he, you know, recreated his party several times because of it. There's always internal disputes about money, about, you know, political positions. There's some sketchy stuff. But the point is, he's the personality and the party follows him. And his latest iteration is the Reform Party.
Yeah.
And the Reform Party, in some sense, has shifted focus. And in fact, you can tell this because it's no longer called the UK Independence Party, it's called the Reform Party. The focus has shifted from the European Union because the United Kingdom is not part of the European Union anymore, much to its detriment, and to something like more like migration issues.
Yeah.
And that has become sort of like the big issue in UK politics.
Right.
That he's making a lot of hay out of that. Right. And you could say you could say Nigel Farage is a political opportunist par excellence.
So back to your telling the story about your friend and some of the workers.
Yeah. Yeah, so
what the significance of that was.
It's very funny because my friend when he was at university with me, he was much more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's actually done something that's considered not so conservative anymore, which is to join the actual Conservative Party, which is like a dying institution because of the takeover on the right by Reform.
Mm-hmm.
But he personally could not stomach Reform, so he decided to essentially fight it from the right. It's almost like a UK version of a never Trump or Republican, right?
Right.
I think the issue is this. I think the issue is that really the demographic he was gesturing at, he was talking about, is what in the UK political advertising business is called the white van man, the man who drives a white van, like a contractor, essentially.
Yeah.
And this person tends to have populist center-right, sometimes right-wing opinions.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., they would probably be receptive or somewhat receptive to Mr. Trump. In the U.K. context, they tend to be more receptive to populist opinions. Mm-hmm. And I think what has happened in the U.K. is a combination of high living costs, flat wages, and more visible xenophobia. Partly due to the way migrant and asylum claimants have been housed by the government, mm-hmm. which is causing a lot of political controversy. So basically what happened was during COVID, the government decided that the most efficient way to house people who have crossed the English Channel in pursuit of asylum is in just by renting out entire hotels.
Right.
That's the most just easiest way to do that. And it's caused, I think, to some extent, a meaningful degree of resentment in the population. Because you take a hotel that has 200 rooms and 300 rooms, I think a lot of the problems are that the migrant and the asylum claimants are not really distributed throughout the population. They're kind of concentrated in this one point.
Probably doesn't aid their integration into
It's partly...
Because they're basically concentrated together with... You know,
yeah, and sometimes it would be like, yeah, exactly.
Right, many people from their own background and culture, so they're in some ways hindered from integrating because they're just surrounded by people like them already.
Yeah, to some extent that's very true, and I think that's actually made worse by the fact that because the way different waves of migration tend to happen, a lot of hotels actually tend to be concentrated with one ethnicity or nationality. And that's probably made the situation worse. But also, it's also the sort of indecisiveness of the policy itself, because very often people are housing these hotels while waiting for processing. And so their status is indeterminate. And I think the government needs to come up with a better way to process people, to house people while they wait for processing.
Right.
Renting out hotels that might be disused or underused in central London or Manchester or Birmingham or any of these places, it's not really the best way of going about this. And this is not just a reflection on populism. It's also